You see, I get it now. I finally understand what the holidays are all about. It feels great. I feel like I'm in my own Christmas special.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Merry Christmas!
Happy Hanukkah.
Hey! Happy Festivus, everyone!
That actually segues well to a point I have here in the notes, and you really kind of devastate this argument, if you will. Sagan originally put it forth, I'm sure he didn't originally put it forth, but that's sort of who you cite, and it's that reproductibility as the essence of science, and how that's sort of used as a crutch by the nasty, noisy negativists, if you will, for why we can't look at UFOs, and you really devastate that whole argument in the book. Talk a little bit about that.
I was at his home. We were classmates for 3 years. We're the same age. Well, I'm still alive, but I'm 4 months older than he was, something like that. And we were in the same classes for 3 years at Chicago. So I was visiting. I was going to be lecturing at Cornell, and the guy in charge was in Carl's department. He was the advisor to the UFO club of Cornell, would you believe? It's surprising that they had one. But anyway, so he took me from the plane to Carl's house, and we had coffee and cookies and so forth, and that's where Carl said something to the effect. I mean, we're cordial to each other. Well, why not? And that's where he said something about reproducibility being the essence of science. So we talked about that briefly. It was a relatively short meeting, but we had a lot of subjects to cover. But I wrote him a letter afterward pointing out, he wrote me on the same day that I wrote him, which is interesting, pointing out that there are several different kinds of science, and they don't all involve reproducibility. I mean, yes, of course, it's nice if you have an experiment, you set it up in the lab, you control all the variables, you take data, you have it peer-reviewed, it gets published in a journal, hopefully somebody else does the same thing and can get the same results. That's very important. We need that, not only in astronomy or physics, but in medicine and a lot of other areas.
Yeah.
However, that's only one kind. A second kind, and certainly Carl knew about this, is where you can predict, but you can't control. Now, if I were to tell somebody, a noisy negativist, that, look, you know, every once in a while, the moon comes between the Earth and the sun, and it gets dark down here in the middle of the day. Ah, come on, that's nonsense. Tomorrow morning, you show me, and I'll have to take pictures. I don't believe you. Well, it's not in my power to adjust, you know, to reproduce the situation, to control it. We can predict it, and hopefully we'll have cameras, and the weather will be okay, and all the rest of that, but I can't reproduce it. There's a third kind. Where you can't predict and you can't control, but where you can make measurements anyway. At Chicago, over at Stagg Field, where the first nuclear chain reaction was conducted, they did play football there at one time. They had a balloon ready to launch with a block of nuclear emulsion hung from it. If we had a signal indicating that there was a solar storm, because the X-rays and the gamma rays get there with the speed of light, we could send this up because the particles are much slower and hopefully recover the balloon and this block of nuclear emulsion and learn the mass and velocity, energy, so forth, of the particles. Can't predict, can't control, can be ready to observe. Think about earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
You set up your seismographs, and you know, I can't make one for you, but I can be ready to observe it.
Yeah.
Then we come to the fourth kind. That's what we're interested in. That's where you can't predict, you can't control, you can't observe at the time because you don't know where they're going to happen. Things that involve intelligence.
Yeah.
We're talking, that's in quotes, rapes, murders, automobile crashes, airplane crashes, UFO sightings. You have to make do with asking questions in a scientific fashion, reserving judgment, gathering data. Automobile crash. 40,000 people will die in the United States this year, roughly, of automobile crashes. Now, I can't tell you where, who, or when, but I can measure alcohol levels in the blood of the driver. I can check the brake linings, look at the skid marks, see what the visibility and the weather condition, and take eyewitness testimony. Bank robbery is the same thing. You know, now if somebody says, well, the robber was 6 feet tall plus or minus 20%, that's not very useful because it covers most of the population. But if you say the object was sitting still in the sky and then moved straight up and then stopped and moved off at 8,000 miles an hour. Now, whether it was 90 degrees vertical or 75 doesn't matter. You know, and whether it was 6,000 or 10,000 miles an hour, we've just described something that's outside the normal. And when you have multiple witness radar visual cases and so forth, you can, Jim McDonald did this in his congressional testimony. He had 41 separate sightings, including a number of multiple witness radar visual cases. When you got the whole crew of a reconnaissance plane that spent 2 hours with a saucer nearby, where they picked up signals from it, and where their radar indicated it was there, and ground radar saw them and the target, I can't make it happen tomorrow because I can't bring the saucer back. But I can be scientific in how I approach the evaluation collection of the data.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my point to Carl, and it's a point that isn't made often enough as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly, yeah. It really stood out in the book to me. I was like,
good.
It's kind of argument we need against the negative is to use the reproducibility argument constantly as a crutch against the UFOs. So it was. It'll come in handy, I'm sure, in the long run. Another point I want to ask you about, just to sort of dive back to the Hills case, is just the whole betrayal aspect of their story, how I found it kind of interesting, for starters, just to look at how different times were back then, because, you know, they wanted to keep the story quiet, but they were talking to NICAP people, Air Force people, their friends, a couple of the UFO groups. It was like, you couldn't get away with that in this day and age.
Oh, no.
People would find out in a heartbeat. The rush to publish first would be amazing.
Remember, no internet back then.
Exactly.
Don't forget.
I guess just talk a little bit about sort of how that thing exploded on the scene. And as a side thing, did this Luterell character who wrote the Boston Traveler article, did he ever regret his decision or apologize to the Hills?
He thought he was – I talked to him once, and he certainly didn't want any more public discussion about the case because of the job he was in, PR for some outfit, and he didn't want to jeopardize, you know It's funny because the overwhelming response to these articles in the paper, which were not 100% accurate, was very favorable.
Yeah.
You remember, Betty and Barty wanted to squash it. He called them, wanted to interview them, and they said, no way, Jose.
Yeah.
And they talked to lawyers to see if there was anything they could do, and there wasn't. Somebody had given them him a tape of a private talk that they had given. And so they were afraid, literally, of losing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And Barney, because of his activities in the civil rights movement, really was concerned about that. I mean, how effective could he be in a civil rights movement if he was being held up as some kind of idiot who'd seen a flying saucer and been taken on board and seen alien beings? You gotta be kidding, you know. And so when the story did come out, it turned out that the response was extraordinarily good. And that's what led, not too long thereafter, when John Fuller showed up. He'd already written Incident at Exeter, or was working on it at the time, which is another fine book. Exeter is a small town in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. not too far away from where the Hills are. I mean, New Hampshire isn't the largest state around.
Yeah.
And so they worked out an agreement, finally, where between the four of them, the Hills, John Fuller, and Dr. Simon. But one of the kickers was that Simon would have final say on everything. He was the professional. Remember, he was a psychiatrist with a Harvard background, a Boston practice, a colonel in the Army during the war, ran this 3,000-bed hospital. This was pretty high up the ladder there, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I've seen his notes. The papers, Fuller is dead and Simon's dead too. Fuller's papers are at the Boston University Archives. And I've seen Simon's comments on manuscript sections, and wow, he minced no words. You can't say this. This would make us look stupid. You can't say that. I don't know how Fuller put up with it. It's probably a better book because of it. But I'm sure, I mean, I'm working on a book now, and I don't think I'd want somebody telling me those things. So the attitude of people toward Betty and Barney was good. Now, it's very unfortunate Barney died in 69, February 1969. Mm-hmm. And so Betty bore the brunt after that, and she had her own views. She liked to think of herself as a UFO researcher. She took people to where she saw lights at night and said, there are the saucers coming back. She was very skeptical about most abduction cases because medical hypnosis wasn't used. She was she accepted the Travis Walton case, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
And she went off in left field a little bit to a lot of people. And I know in one case she showed pictures at a meeting in New York taken with a Polaroid camera, and there are lights moving around in the sky, seemingly. These were stills. And I asked her for some information about the camera, and she didn't know. So I talked to Polaroid, and it turned out that particular model was used by artists because when it's dark, the lens, the shutter stays open for many seconds.
Ah.
And so what you're getting is movement of the camera, not movement of the object.
Yeah.
And she hadn't done any of that, so she really wasn't an investigator, but the pictures helped convince her that she was seeing something extraordinary, or didn't see something. I mean, she saw the lights, and look what the camera shows, and cameras don't lie. So she didn't pull a phony or anything like that. She just didn't understand what was going on. And Kathy, you know, Kathleen Martin knew about the case the day after it happened, not about the abduction part of it. But she was there when Betty called Kathy's mother, Betty's sister,
mm-hmm.
the very next day. And so she saw the marks on the car. You know, there are these peculiar marks. We still don't understand why a compass went wild on those. Wish we had the car to check tonight.
Yeah.
We don't. And so Kathy got a little dubious with all these other things going on. And so when Betty gave her the tapes, she transcribed them all. And it turns out that John Fuller hadn't used all the information that was on the tapes. It turns out Simon asked the same questions sometimes three or four different ways.
Yeah.
And so looking at things from a different perspective, that was his standard approach to doing this kind of thing. There's a lot in the book that you will not have seen before,
yeah.
No matter if you read The Interrupted Journey.
Absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of tons of new material in the book. All right, well, another question I kind of have for you, and it's a great segue from what you're just talking about with The Interrupted Journey. And you point out in Captured that The Interrupted Journey, it's been out of print since around 88. Why do you think the Hill story kind of fell out of the popularity loop, if you will, eventually? I remember back when I was a kid in the 80s, you know, the Hill case was like a staple of paranormal anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like the number 2, 3, 4 story that you'd get if someone was going to do a paranormal special or books or magazines or anything like that. Why do you think the Hill case fell out of the loop, if you will?
I think it's a couple of things. One, let's face it, there were new books about abductions. Bud wrote several books. Dr. David Jacobs wrote several books.
Mm-hmm.
There was newer material to chew on, many different cases. Remember that The Interrupted Journey talks about one abduction case.
Yeah.
And now most of these other books will mention the Hill case at some point along the way. But there was a lot of stuff going on. So, you know, newer is better, right?
Exactly.
Latest model. All that kind of thing. Also, Betty wasn't doing much anymore in the media kind of world. She'd done quite a lot over periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no reason for people to focus on it. And, you know, the UFO incident, the television movie, is still not available on DVD.
Wow.
And, you know, if it was, I'm sure it would sell extremely well. But I approached James Earl Jones, who had the movie rights, but he doesn't anymore. And I dealt with somebody who's close to him, and so he's not involved. I mean, I think what would be great is if Oprah had James on, and maybe Kathy, to talk about the story. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, well, they got to get you then, too, for sure. So.
Well, it would help the book sales, that's for sure. I should add, incidentally, the book is listed on Amazon,
mm-hmm.
of course, and Barnes & Noble and all that. Or they can get it from me or from Kathy. And if you get it from us, you get both signatures. We signed 1,000 book plates.
Nice.
And that you won't get from the stores. So I'm all in favor of people buying books from stores, but I'm just saying that you can, my website, which we haven't mentioned, www.stantonfriedman.com, has a link to Kathy's website as well, and tells you how to get the book with PayPal or send a check or whatever, and also has my other books, Crash at Corona, The Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident, and Top Secret / Magic about the Majestic 12 documents. Boy, you want controversy. There's still a lot of that floating around.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you can grab those books and find more information at www.stantonfriedman.com. Capture's got great distribution. I see it all over the place at my Barnes & Noble and Borders and stuff, so I'm psyched to see that. Well, I want to just touch on one element of new information that came out in the book. Maybe, I don't know, it might have been an interrupted journey. I'm not sure, because it's been out of print, so I haven't been able to get my hands on it. And that's this pile of dried leaves / earrings that were found on the table about 2 months after the abduction on November. I guess just talk about that thing, because that's totally bizarre and jaw-dropping when I read it in the book.
Yeah, there are a couple of those things that happened. Betty with her arm in a cast, and somehow the cast was, this is many years later, of course. Mm-hmm. It appears that the aliens were paying attention. I don't know of a better way to say it. Now, everybody knows, if you read Bud's books and David's books and so forth, that there seemed to be, for many people, more than one abduction. And even to have it run in families, so to speak, parents and then children. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a Canadian abductee, and she had an encounter with, I asked her the question, you know, why you? Because she wanted to know too. And she said something to the effect that something about me, I was easy to track. And remember in the conversation between Betty and the aliens, they said that she wanted to introduce them to people who knew about astronomy on the planet.
Yeah.
And they said, we can find you. We'll be able to find you. So it appears that the aliens have, whether it's these implants that people have talked about, I mean, you can buy commercial devices about the size of a BB that you can insert in an animal and will respond to a transponder, you know, name, rank, serial number, so to speak. It's being used with cattle and with pets and no reason why it couldn't be used with people. And if we can do that already, then somebody with a little more advanced technology than ours can certainly do it. So it appeared that these guys, aliens, call them what you want, these strange characters from Zeta Reticuli, were keeping track and did something to show their presence. Now, there's another part of this, and this came home to me when I was at the crash, at the abduction site, not the crash site, with Kathy. When you're there, it seems perfectly obvious that Barney would never have gotten off the main road onto a secondary road, and off the secondary road to a tertiary dirt road at the time. It's paved now, but, well, there was that's the one area, this is a very heavily wooded area near Lincoln, New Hampshire. And there was a place big enough for the craft to set down, sandy area, I don't know why. And so clearly they were able to mentally control the behavior of Betty and Barney, especially Barney, he was driving. Mm-hmm. And so if you can do that, action at a distance, you know, we put a gun to somebody's head, a knife to their throat, et cetera. The aliens seem to be able to telepathize, if I can use that word, or to read our minds, or whatever you want to call it. So they may have been checking. I had the feeling, when you read the accounts, and I've listened to a couple of the tapes, incidentally, and that's pretty strong stuff. As a matter of fact, Dr. Simon had said to Jim McDonald that the emotional intensity in a couple of those sessions was greater than that with any of the Shell Shock War veterans. And coming from him, that's pretty strong stuff. So what I'm getting at here is that apparently the aliens were able to contact, and I presume it's sort of a two-way street. Now, whether they put a transponder in either one of them or not, I don't know. Whether they had a peculiar signal. Can you imagine what the response would have been from the first guy who said, you know, I can measure electrical signals from a brain?
Yeah.
How loud would the laughter have been on that one? There's no battery there. What are you talking about? That seems to be an aspect of this whole business. And incidentally, can you imagine how concerned governments would be in trying to find out more about that? Wouldn't it be great if you could get a half an army to lay down its arms with a mental message?
Well, I'll just sort of like give the thumbnail on the story. Was just that they had gone out, they came home, in the middle of the tables, this pile of dried leaves, and inside is Betty's earrings that she was wearing the night of the
yes.
abduction. And this is 2 months after the abduction, way before the story became like massively popular. I mean, only a handful of people really kind of knew what was going on with the Hills at the time. So we can kind of rule out, you know, wacky, crazy people who would have broken in and done it. But did anything else ever come out of that or anything?
No.
Just sort of like just a weird anomaly that adds more mystery to the whole thing.
That's about all it was. That's one of the places where you wish that Dr. Simon had pursued that a bit more, you know?
Yeah.
Can they remember what happened to her earrings? Does she remember taking them off? Or, I mean, how do you get earrings off and normally have to take them off, don't you?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's strange that they turn up like 2 months later, too. It's really bizarre,
yeah.
Really weird one.
I had the feeling that the aliens hadn't done a lot of abductions before this. You know, maybe this is the first time around for the professor and his class. I mean, I love that part where they pull on Barney's teeth.
yeah. They seem definitely a little at odds with the human element when they abducted Betty and Barney, and, you know, they couldn't work the zipper on Betty's dress. And the whole thing with the teeth, it was very strange. It has a whole lot of elements to trying to figure out what they're all about.
But it did have the ring of truth, didn't it? Who would make up a story like that?
Yeah, because if you're going to make it up, that kind of stuff wouldn't even get into the story, because you would think that it wouldn't be believable or something like that.
That's
but
right.
It makes it even more believable when you think about it. To jump to kind of like I was saying, how the Hill story sort of fell out of the loop, you're sort of interested in, and I've really become really interested in strange things that have kind of fallen out of the loop in a way. And I was talking to you before we did the interview about Keith Chester's book about the Foo Fighters, which I'm just raving about lately. And I know that you're kind of interested in another element to that historical aspect of ufology, and that's the whole shoot them down story. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I know it's one of the big things that you've been interested in the past few years.
Well, yeah, Frank Fascino Jr. and I got together a few years ago at a conference, and he'd been working on the Flatwoods Monster case, but all in sort of quiet, like he would use a false name when he sought information and so forth. And I finally pushed him to, you know, you got to write a book, Frank, and so forth. And this one is his second book, because I was intrigued by all the plane crashes in 52. Somebody had objected to the stories in the Braxton County Monster. The publisher had done a lousy job, hadn't corrected 100 and some errors that Frank had spotted and listed, and he just let him go right on through. And so there were people who were saying that, gee whiz, there were no dog fights between saucers and aircraft and so forth. So I asked for help from David Rudiak and Barry Greenwood if they had any more clippings about the Flatwoods Monster case. Was September 12, 1952, right after the sightings over Washington, you know, and all big fuss in 52. So they came up with lots of articles, huge collections, and lo and behold, there were the articles where the Air Force instructed its pilots to shoot them down if they don't land when ordered to do so.
Yeah.
And you started looking around, and, gee, the New York Times and Washington Post didn't say that. And then also, Frank found, the New York Times included over 200 accounts of military interceptors crashing between 1951 and 55. And sometimes the words disintegrated and disappeared were used. And three of the pilots were people who'd had over 100 combat missions in Korea, where there were MiGs trying to shoot them down.
Yeah.
They survived that, and they come back to the States, and they crashed. Also, General Ramey, the same Ramey from the Roswell case, but now he was a major general, made a public statement that we'd scrambled them hundreds of times. And I hadn't known a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't in the Times or the Washington Post and so forth. So Frank's book goes into that, and I have heard over the years, the other side of the same coin, seven different accounts of planes going up after UFOs and not coming back. If I've heard seven, I mean, yeah, I've been around a long time, but still, if I've heard seven, there's got to be a lot more than that. I wouldn't have heard of them all.
Mm-hmm.
And these weren't people seeking attention. Believe me, they weren't.
Yeah.
They might approach me after a lecture quietly in a corner kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole aspect of the whole situation. We're getting back to General Bolander. Apparently, these are reports which could affect national security. Now, I know some people say, what do you mean, Stan? Planes got shot down by UFOs and the families didn't know about it? Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. There's a wonderful book called By Any Means Necessary by William E. Burroughs, B-U-R-R-O-W-S, published in 2001. And he recounts the stories of 166 military crew members of Air Force planes that were doing reconnaissance approaching North Korea, China, and Russia, mostly in the late 40s, early 50s. None of the families were told. These planes were shot down. None of the families were told. Unfortunate accident at sea, body not recovered. It seems that the Russians would have grabbed some of these guys and tortured them because we weren't going to say anything publicly because we were violating international law.
Yeah.
And they weren't going to say anything publicly either because we shot down some of their planes. But if you got 166 guys whose families were told nothing until they had a big meeting in 2001 and gave medals to the families. So a few other airplanes, and I've got one guy I've got to follow up on. He had told a buddy, he's dead, but he had told a friend of his from college when he came back from flying in Europe, Germany, in the early 50s, that we had lost 20 planes to UFOs.
Oh, wow.
And Tim Good in his new book suggests some of the same things.
Huh.
Need to Know, I guess, is the title of Tim's book. So what I'm saying is this is an aspect of the whole problem that hasn't been considered, and it's why I recommend Frank's book, Shoot Them Down. And I wrote the foreword and the epilogue for it. And we'd certainly like to hear from crew members who knew about planes not coming back.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I don't expect to hear from the guys who didn't come back. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, and my address and so forth are on the website, www.stantonfriedman.com. I'll give out my email address, FS for Flying Saucer, PHYS for Physicist, at rogers.com. And I do normally answer email. Not so good about snail mail.
Well, it's tough nowadays. Now, this is a question somebody sent me after last year's Christmas special, so I kind of filed it away to make sure I asked you this year. And in the last couple of years or so, it seems, there's been a rebirth, if you will, in the argument behind the ETH theory, as the kids like to call it, extraterrestrial hypothesis, which you seem to be a big fan of, versus the whole multiple dimension theory and all the other various theories that go along with where the UFOs are coming from and what they're all about. I guess, what are your thoughts on the ETH hypothesis versus the other ones? Are you open-minded about those possible multiple dimensional ideas, or are you pretty much solid on the ETH thing?
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
I would be totally astonished if an advanced civilization hadn't figured out how to warp space and time, if they can figure out telepathy, let's say, and probably reincarnation and all this other stuff that we call paranormal. I mean, I can't imagine an advanced civilization only being concerned about nuts and bolts.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem comes from the fact that I worked on advanced propulsion systems like nuclear fusion and fission and so forth in large-scale programs where the data was classified and that most academics have never heard of and aren't aware of. So I have an unfair advantage. Furthermore, I worked under security for 14 years, and I've been to 20 archives. So I know governments can cover things up. There are loads of examples. Big programs, multi-billion dollar a year programs that we didn't know about for 30 years. The Poppy satellite, the Corona satellite, you know, there were a number of these. And the stealth airplane, 10 years, $10 billion before there was a word in public. So I can't see a problem with the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Now remember, unlike Dr. Kaku, who started a program we did by saying, gee, it's taking an awful lot of energy to get to the next galaxy. I don't worry about the next galaxy.
Yeah.
That's Andromeda's 2 million light years away. Okay, I'm worried about down the street, 39 light years away.
Yeah.
There's a big, enormous difference there.
Mm-hmm.
So I am not a fan of the others as the primary explanation. Whether they're warping space and time to get here or using a big old fusion-powered mothership, it doesn't matter. They're from someplace else coming here. Now, how you get here is really beside the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, when you boil it down.
Yeah.
I can't build one. Nobody's going to fund me to build one. But I do have an appreciation for how much technology is represented, especially by these mothership reports.
Mm-hmm.
Half-mile-long object in the sky? Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive, you know. Look, if I had told a naval hero 200 years ago that we would have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can go for 18 years without refueling and carry 75 high-performance supersonic airplanes, he'd have tossed me in the loony bin pretty darn quick, wouldn't he?
I'm afraid so. Well, let's talk about your, as you already have called it, your magnum opus, and probably what we're going to be talking about on next year's holiday special, if
hope
you will.
So.
I hope so, too. And that's the next book you got coming up, Flying Saucers and Science. I guess, talk about it. Why is it your magnum opus? It sounds like this is going to be amazing, so let's hear all about it.
Well, look, over the years, I figure I've answered over 40,000 questions. I've lectured at 600 colleges, well over 100 professional groups, done hundreds of radio and television programs, and I get asked lots of questions. And people have no trouble accepting the data I present. Facts are facts, you know. But they always want to know the why questions. Why the cover-up, for example?
Yeah.
Why would aliens come here? Why don't the aliens land on the White House lawn? And so I've tried to put together into a book, which gives me much more space than a 90-minute lecture or a 10-minute interview or even a 90-minute interview, try to get it all together in one big fat volume. And it's time that I did that. You know, not that I'm saying I'm going to die next week because I'm very healthy, but only that it would be a shame if I didn't put it all together.
Yeah.
Put it on record, so to speak. And look, I can come down. I don't have a boss to worry about except me.
Yeah.
So I can do a whole chapter on the cosmic Watergate, which the subject represents. I can talk about the cult of SETI, you know, which will make some people mad, but what the heck? I'm sorry. The facts are what they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's not science. It's belief systems. I think it's hilarious that city people say there is no evidence for UFOs. They got no evidence there's anybody out there sending a signal of any kind.
Yeah.
And we got tons of evidence, the five large-scale scientific studies that I talk about in my lectures, and I know a lot of people in ufology aren't aware of those studies, so I think it's time to put it all down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really looking forward to it, because the why questions part of your other book, Top Secret Magic, is one of my favorite chapters in that whole book. I go back and read that a lot, so it sounds like this is going to be an expansion of that whole thing, so I'm looking forward to it. When do you think people are going to be able to pick up Flying Saucers and Science?
Oh, late May.
All right, nice. Sounds good. And that's
what they tell me. Who knows? The book business is crazy.
Yeah. That's through New Page Books, right?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, they're the same people who published Captured, and they surprised me. We submitted a proposal because by contract agreement, I have to give them first crack at my next book anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, let's see how Captured does. And then 2 weeks later, hey, we decided to publish it.
Awesome. That sounds great. I'm really looking forward to it. It sounds like this one's going to be just a home run book. Have you ever thought about doing an autobiography at all?
I've thought about it, and I try to let little autobiographical dribs and drabs into my books, which surprises some people and pleases others. I've thought about it, but you know, a book I'd like to do after this one is It's Impossible, Isn't It? With all the crazy claims that have been made by the ancient academics and fossilized physicists about what's impossible that turn out to be quite possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And how many such claims are being made today? And how much progress has been hindered by the big shots saying it can't be done who don't know what they're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah, you do a good job of pointing that out about the trip to the moon and all the various people that said it couldn't be done and all their crazy estimates on what it would take to put somebody up in orbit and stuff. That's a very entertaining part of the book. Yeah, I ask about the autobiography because just in some of the interviews that you and I have done talking about, you know, the UFO field over the years and stuff, and even the foreword or the introduction here in Captured, there's a lot of autobiographical stuff in there that I was just, like, loving, you know. So I think it would be a great book to put out. There's not too many people who really talk about the history of the field and what was going on at the time and stuff, and you had a great window on the evolution of ufology through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, now. I highly recommend it. You should definitely do it.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
Definitely, definitely. I'll be just elated if that comes together. What do you have coming up on the horizon for 2008? You know, speaking engagements, anything you want to mention or plug,
well,
specials and stuff? Let's hear it.
I should mention that the Aztec UFO Symposium, Aztec, New Mexico, is going to take place toward the end of March, and I'm excited about that. I've been there before, but... Scott Ramsey has done an awful lot of good research on that, and I'll see the guys again, and I always like going to New Mexico anyway. Yvonne Smith has a new book coming out about abductions, and she's going to have Kathy and I at the Cerro. Oh, that's a long thing. She has an abduction group in Southern California, and so at the end of April, that'll be out there. I'm sure there'll be publicity for that. I'll put all this on my website.
Yeah.
And the people in Roswell have told me they want me there. We don't have any specifics lined up yet. It's a little early, but so I expect to be in Roswell again, and last year was the 60th anniversary, so I don't suppose there's anything special about 61st.
Now, I know you went to China a couple years ago. Any big international trips or anything like that?
Not at the moment, although I've intentionally not tried to book any lectures the last few months. I want to work on the book.
Yeah.
And then when it's done, then we'll start trying to book some lectures. I mean, I can't sit still.
Yeah. Just to sort of jump on the China thing, what other countries would you like to go to that you haven't got a chance to go to yet? I mean, have you been to Japan or
Japan is one. Now, I've been to Australia several times, Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, Finland, France, Germany, Italy, Israel, Turkey, England, Scotland, Ireland. I'd love to speak in Russia, for example.
Yeah.
Poland guy did a long interview with me, and that was interesting. And so Japan would be high on the list. I enjoyed China. Love to go back. I was to Hong Kong and Dalian, which is northeastern China. I've spoken in Seoul, Korea. There's a lot of interest out there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm trying to get into the Japanese scene, find someone to talk to, have on the show. So I'll throw your name out there to tell them to bring you over to Japan
when I
get a hold of someone from Japan to talk to. Well, Stan, I got to thank you so much, not just for coming on the show, giving me some extra time here for the interview. I really appreciate it. The book, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, Stan co-wrote it with Kathleen Martin. It is outstanding, my friends. It is an amazing book. It really talks about the whole evolution of the Betty and Barney Hill story, gives a great biographical sketch of Betty and Barney Hill. You're going to learn so much more about them as people. I was stunned to find out so much about Barney's civil rights work. Sounds like he did just a tremendous amount of civil rights work in the time, and I never heard that kind of stuff. I'd only been really vaguely familiar with the UFO abduction story of Betty and Barney Hill. And this book will give you a tremendous education on the whole thing. I can't put it over enough. It's from New Page Books. As Stan said, you can find it just about anywhere, any bookstore. You can get the autographed copies through Stan's website, www.stantonfriedman.com. Stan, like I said at the beginning, you're a living legend. I love having you on the show. I always look forward to the holiday season because I know we're going to be taping the holiday special, and all my listeners are always, you know, we're looking forward to it. I get emails all the time about it. You know, you're going to have Stan back for the holiday special this year, right? Of course I am. So it's great to have you back. I had a great time talking to you, and hopefully we'll be doing this again next year to talk about flying saucers and science.
My pleasure. Happy holidays.
That does it for the third annual BOA Audio Holiday Special. I can't thank Stanton Friedman enough for coming back on the show, for embracing the whole holiday special atmosphere of the program. He is the man. His new book, Captured, is outstanding. I can't put it over enough, as I said in the interview. It is great, great reading and a very personal look at a major UFO story. Of course, you can find out more information on Stanton Friedman at the website, www.stantonfriedman.com. Definitely check it out. Moving right along, it would be time for BOA Audio listener feedback, but since this is the holiday special, I want to give a little feedback to all the great BOA Audio listeners and wish them a very Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and a festive holiday season. We'll bring back listener feedback next week and in further installments, don't you worry about that. The mailbag is piling up as I speak, so you know how to get a hold of me, boaaudio@hotmail.com, or via the BOA website. And, of course, we extend super huge thanks and a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to the tremendous BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., and Tina Senna. You guys are the best, and I could not do what I do without the outstanding BOA staff. So thank you very much to all of them, and may they have a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. I'm excited to announce we'll be adding a new member of the staff in 2008. More details to come on our impending new addition to BOA, a fantastic writer who'll be joining the staff in the not-too-distant future. We'll cut back on the plugs this week, folks. You know we need your help to keep the show and the website up and running. You know how to do that. You either buy stuff from the BOA store or make a donation via PayPal to BOA. Next week on the program, we're going to close out 2007 with a major superstar in the world of esoterica. The extremely popular Nick Redfern will return to BOA Audio to discuss his latest book, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. We did 2 hours worth of awesome material covering a ton of ground, a lot of big picture analysis, a lot of cryptozoology discussion, a lot of sociological discussion on just the various fields and what have you. It's a great episode. I know many people are going to dig this one. That's Nick Redfern talking about Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. And I'll give you fair warning now, following that episode, we'll be taking our annual winter hiatus, probably for 3 or 4 weeks in January. And we'll be back with new episodes at the end of that month. I'll have details on all that, of course, next week at the end of the program. And on that note, we don't have anything left to talk about, folks. It's the end of the show. Once again, big thanks to Stan Friedman. Big thanks to the BOA staff. Big thanks to all the great websites who help promote the BOA brand. Talking about The Anomalist, Daily Grail, UFO Review, About.com, all the various blogs that have been instrumental in helping us get the word out on the series. Big thanks to them and a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to all those great folks. And, of course, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays to all the great BOA Audio listeners. You guys are the best. Come on back next week, Nick Redfern. Till then, have a fantastic holiday season. This is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.